Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Good to be here.
Okay, today we're tackling something absolutely essential. It's the core leadership requirements from the SAPR program.
That's right. Specifically, we're pulling from Module 4, the Colorado Army National Guard's Training Support Package.
Yep.
That's COARing.
Right, COARing. And look, this isn't just about checking a training box. We're aiming this squarely at you, the Army leader.
Exactly. The mission here is really to equip you with practical, usable knowledge. So when a disclosure happens, and it likely will, you're ready.
Ready to respond immediately, correctly, and crucially through what we call a trauma-informed lens.
That's the heart of it. It's moving past just knowing the rules to really understanding why they exist for both prevention and effective response. That's the leadership challenge.
Okay, let's unpack that. We have to start with the absolute foundation, defining the crime itself, sexual assault.
We know the basics. Intentional sexual contact involving force, threats, intimidation, abuse of authority.
Or, and this is key, when the victim does not or cannot consent. And that word consent, that's where things get complex legally, right?
Absolutely. Under the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, consent has a very specific definition. It has to be a freely given agreement to the conduct.
By a competent person.
By a competent person, yes. And 2 points here are non-negotiable for leaders for your formations. First, consent isn't permanent. It can be withdrawn.
At any time. Someone says stop, it stops.
Immediately. The agreement is over. Second, and this gets missed sometimes, lack of consent doesn't always need an explicit no. It can be inferred.
Inferred from the circumstances.
Exactly, from the situation itself.
Okay, now here's a common fiction point for leaders.
Yeah.
Alcohol. Impairment and consent.
Yeah, this is critical. The UCMJ is very direct here. If you engage in sexual acts with someone when you know, or reasonably should have known, they can't consent because they're impaired.
By drugs or alcohol.
Then that's a crime, period.
And the standard for being incapable of consenting is quite specific.
It is. It means they're incapable of apprising the nature of the conduct, basically, understanding what's happening. Or they're physically unable to decline or communicate unwillingness.
Which leads to a really crucial point you highlighted.
Yes. There is no set amount of alcohol, no specific BAC level that automatically legally means someone cannot consent.
That's huge. It means leaders can't just, you know, look for a number. There's no checklist for blood alcohol content.
Precisely. It forces leaders away from simplistic checks and towards assessing the actual capacity of the person to consent in that moment. It's about their observable ability to comprehend and agree. A much harder judgment call, but necessary.
Okay, so that's the definition. Now, connecting this specifically for our Colorado Army National Guard leaders.
Right, the court.
Defining the crime is step one, but then which laws actually apply? Is it federal or state?
The jurisdictional piece. This is essential for COARing leaders to nail down.
Because it changes depending on duty status.
Exactly. If your soldiers are on Title 10 Orders Active Duty, then the UCMJ applies. Article 120, 117A, 132, and so on. Serious stuff. Severe maximum punishments.
But most COARing soldiers, most of the time, are in Title 32 status. Drills. Stay active duty.
And in Title 32 status, the Colorado Code of Military Justice, the CCMJ, applies. That's governed by state law.
Which means punishments, procedures, they might be different.
They can be significantly different. The key takeaway. Leaders must consult with JA, the Judge Advocate General. Don't guess. Get guidance based on that soldier's specific status.
Okay, so we have the legal framework. Now let's talk about who has to report. Mandatory reporters.
That includes commanders, the whole chain of command supervisors, first sergeants, plus instructors, law enforcement. They're all mandatory reporters.
But there was a major policy shift recently, wasn't there, in 2022, regarding how this reporting works with victim choice.
A huge shift. And this addresses that tension between the command's duty to report and the victim's right to choose their path.
So the chain of command is still required to report the assault to law enforcement, regardless of what the victim wants.
Yes, that obligation remains. The commander must report the information indicating a sexual assault occurred to law enforcement, typically CID.
But, and this is the crucial update, that commander's report doesn't automatically force it into an unrestricted report for the victim.
Exactly. That's the key distinction. The victim still retains their choice between restricted and unrestricted reporting within the SAPR system.
Okay, let's break that down. How does that work? The commander reports, but the victim chooses.
Think of it operationally. The commander fulfills their legal duty by reporting the information about the potential crime, But the victim controls the pathway for support and investigation within the military system. Their choice dictates what happens next.
So let's clearly define those two pathways, restricted versus unrestricted. What's the core difference?
Restricted reporting is all about confidentiality. The victim discloses only to specific people, a SARC, a victim advocate, VA, or healthcare personnel.
And what does that get them?
Access to vital support, medical care, counseling, the SAFE kit, the sexual assault forensic exam. That kit is kept for 10 years, by the way.
But the trade-off is?
No official military investigation, no command involvement usually, and no formal accountability process for the offender initiated through that report.
Okay. Then there's unrestricted reporting.
Right. This path does initiate an official investigation through the chain of command, law enforcement, or both.
And with this option, the victim gets all the support services.
Yes. Medical, counseling, VA support, SAFE kit, plus command support, protective measures, and the possibility of holding the offender accountable through the military justice system or administrative action.
And the whole idea of restricted reporting, the ability to keep it confidential, really hinges on a specific rule, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It relies entirely on Military Rule of Evidence 514, MRE 514. This is the legal cornerstone of confidentiality in the SAPR program.
Explain MRE 514. Why is it so important for building trust?
It creates a legal privilege. Communications between a victim and their SARC or their SAPR VA, made specifically for getting advice or assistance, are protected.
Meaning the SARC and VA are not mandatory reporters like the command.
Correct. They hold that confidentiality. Their records, their conversations with the victim, generally aren't released to commanders or law enforcement.
Nevertheless, there must be exceptions.
There are, but they're limited and specific. Things like if the victim gives written permission, if there's an imminent threat of serious harm to someone, child abuse reporting requirements, or if a military judge orders disclosure in a court martial. But otherwise, that confidentiality is protected. It's designed to make victims feel safe coming forward.
That makes sense. It's vital leaders understand who holds that privilege. Now, what about victims who choose restricted reporting but maybe still want to help identify potential repeat offenders?
That's where the CATCH program comes in. CATCH, pronounced catch.
What does CATCH do?
It allows someone who filed a restricted report to voluntarily and anonymously submit information about the suspect or the incident. Maybe a description, location, circumstances.
Why? What's the goal?
The goal is to potentially identify serial offenders. If multiple anonymous reports point to the same person or pattern, DOD investigators can see that linkage. But the victim's confidentiality under restricted reporting is maintained.
And participation is voluntary.
Completely voluntary. The information stays active in the CTH database for 10 years, aligning with the SafeKit retention period. It's a way to contribute intelligence without triggering an investigation of their specific report.
Okay, we've covered the definitions, the legal nuances, the reporting options, confidentiality. Let's shift to practical application scenarios.
Right, because this is where policy meets reality, often under pressure. These vignettes really test a leader's ability to apply this knowledge ethically and quickly.
Using that trauma-informed lens we mentioned.
Exactly. Let's look at vignette 10, the mobile training team, MTT, TDY scenario.
Okay, lay out the situation.
You have a Sergeant Spears, STT Spears, involved in an inappropriate but known consensual relationship with a Captain Dudley, CPT Dudley. They travel TDY together often.
Right.
One night, Captain Dudley is complaining to his teammates that Sergeant Spears won't do certain things sexually. He then laughs, shows them a baggie with Ambien, and says he put one in her drink to facilitate assaulting her. Then he leaves for her room.
Okay, analysis. The prior relationship, even if inappropriate.
Irrelevant.
Yeah.
Completely irrelevant to the assault about to happen. Drugging someone to override their ability to consent, that's premeditated sexual assault, plain and simple.
But the key leadership takeaway here isn't just identifying the crime. It's the failure that happened before he even got to her room.
Precisely. The bystander intervention failure. His teammates heard his explicit plan. They saw the drug he intended to use as a weapon.
They had an absolute obligation to act right then.
A non-negotiable obligation. Intervene, directly stop him. Delgate calls someone higher up immediately. Distract him to do something to prevent him from reaching her room and carrying out that plan.
Failure to act means the assault likely occurred. So the after-the-fact response has to be immediate. CID, medical support.
Immediate. But the focus for prevention, for training, is on stopping it before it happens.
Yeah.
That bystander piece is critical.
Let's take another one. Vignette 11, soldiers drinking in the barracks.
Okay. Situation. Specialist Sam, Specialist Williams, and Specialist Gordon are drinking. SPC Sam becomes extremely intoxicated, passes out, completely unresponsive.
SPC Williams then lies to SPC Gordon to get him to leave the room.
Right, and once Gordon leaves, Williams sexually assaults the motionless, unresponsive SPC Sam.
Clear weaponization of alcohol again. SPC Sam was obviously unable to consent. Motionless, unresponsive, medically and legally incapacitated.
Absolutely. But again, let's focus on the leadership and bystander aspect. What about SPC Gordon?
He knew SPC Sam was really intoxicated. He saw Williams prevent him from moving her somewhere safe.
That should have been an immediate red flag. His attempt to help was blocked by someone whose intentions were questionable at best.
So what should he have done?
Seek external help immediately. Call the charge of quarters, the first sergeant, maybe even MPs or 911, depending on the situation. Prioritizing avoiding conflict over ensuring the safety of an incapacitated soldier, that was the failure.
And for SBC Sam, upon waking up,
the best immediate step is to contact a SARC. Explore her options, discuss restricted or unrestricted reporting, especially while evidence might still be recoverable through a SEAF kit.
These scenarios really drive home the need for immediate, decisive, and ethical leadership response. Okay, finally, let's talk command tools. What can leaders do after an unrestricted report is filed to protect the victim?
There are specific tools available. A major one is an expedited transfer or reassignment.
This is only for unrestricted reports,
correct? Yes, only unrestricted. Army policy actually creates a presumption in favor of granting the victim's request for a transfer, assuming the report is deemed credible.
Can it be temporary or permanent?
Both. Temporary transfers, like moving someone to a different company or battalion on the same post, usually need approval from the first general officer in the chain of command. Permanent change of station, PCS transfers, go through HRC.
And there's a more immediate short-term protective measure a commander can issue.
That's the Military Protective Order, or MPO. A commander can issue an MPO against a service member under their command involved in the report.
What's the purpose of an MPO?
It's a lawful order intended to prevent contact between the alleged offender and the victim, safeguard the victim, and maintain good order and discipline within the unit while things are being investigated or adjudicated.
But there's a critical limitation leaders need to explain, right?
A very important one. MPOs are command tools. They are not enforceable by civilian authorities off post.
So if the victim needs protection outside the gate, say at their home in Denver or Colorado Springs,
they need a civilian protective order, a CPO, from a local civilian court. The MPO doesn't automatically provide that off-post protection. Leaders need to make sure victims understand this distinction clearly.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground, from the fine points of consent and jurisdiction
to the critical updates in reporting policy, the power of MRE 514 confidentiality,
and the hard realities of bystander intervention seen in the vignettes, plus the command tools like transfers and MPOs.
I think we've reinforced that foundation. Leaders should have a clear grasp now on the legal standards, the importance of confidentiality, and how that 2022 policy preserves victim choice, even with mandatory reporting. Understanding this system is key to that trauma-informed response.
So let's bring it back to you, the leader listening. We've talked about the serious consequences, UCMJ, CCMJ, the damage these incidents caused. The vignettes showed where intervention failed.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge, the provocative thought for you is this. What concrete internal mechanisms can you establish in your unit today to make sure that kind of bystander intervention, the kind needed in vignettes 10 and 11, isn't just hoped for, but becomes the immediate, reflexive, non-negotiable standard? How do you build that culture proactively?
That's the work that builds real prevention.